Hello and welcome to the Modern Romantic Podcast, where we celebrate and inspire romanticism through passionate people doing incredible things. Hi, I'm dancing my way into your heart for this Valentine's. Hi, I'm Trey. And I'm joined by my host that is always shaking her head at me for these introductions. Hi, Emily.
You know, I don't want for cheese, that's for sure. Hi, Trey. How's it going?
Great, Emily. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm celebrating Valoween, okay. Which is like second chance Halloween. I feel like that's like leftover Halloween. I don't want it to sound that way. I want it to be like second breakfast, elevensies. I want it to be something you look forward to. It's a second Halloween. It's really like a first Halloween, depending on how you look at it. Anyway, we're going to do that.
Okay. I support this very much. Well, Emily, without further ado, I can't wait to dive into talking to our guest this evening. Would you do the honors of introducing our guest?
Absolutely. I would be honored to. Today, we have the most remarkable Shonda Sawyer, a multi-talented director, choreographer, and executive producer, whose visionary work has garnered awards, captivated audiences worldwide. And we're so lucky to have her here today to chat with her. So welcome to the podcast, Shonda.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yay. Thank you. Absolutely. By the way, I have to say, I love that picture behind you on the wall. I know our listening only audience can't see it, but it's like this cool globe, almost like an astrolabe kind of thing, old world map.
Here, maybe a little tilt up.
So you can love see- it.
Ooh, gyroscopic detail.
Yeah. That's up my alley.
Makes me feel smart to sit in front of it. It doesn't really work, but I feel smart.
Oh, so I need one. That's all that counts, right?
I do have to ask, where did you get that?
You know, I don't remember. I think that it was a friend's and they were moving and they gave it to me. And so it just ended up in my dining room.
Ooh. Okay. Good gift.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I need to find friends like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Give us the cool old world gifts like that. I love it. So you are multi-talented and have like quite a few really cool things under your belt, and I want to talk about those. But how did you get started? Were you a dancer when you were a kid?
Yes. I have a kind of an interesting origin story, only because I grew up in Berkeley and we had crazy hippie parents who kind of disappeared a little bit on us during a certain period of time in Berkeley. And we ended up, my older sister and I ended up having to kind of support ourselves, basically. So we rolled a big Persian carpet out in front of Cost Plus over in Fisherman's Wharf. We're like 14 and 16 probably at the time. And we danced on the street. But we did like a whole libretto with like storylines and fighting over the musicians. And we dressed up all our little high school friends like gypsies. And so we were basically the ROM, we called ourselves, gypsy dance troupe. Cool. And we had, you know, a science where we would get like all the money from the people with the little tambourines passing and all that stuff. And we actually did really well. And I'll tell you, I always look back at that as being what gave me my really good showbiz instincts. Because, you know, when you think about it, people are not, they didn't buy a ticket to your show. They're going somewhere else. They've got things to do. They're not really interested in seeing a show. So if you can keep them there, you know, you really, really are doing a great job. So I think my instincts were honed at that early age. And then I had dance companies in college and then a theater company that was actually kind of a huge cult hit in San Francisco, the comedy theater dance company, where we took over the nightclubs and on their nights off and, you know, had our crazy wild shows, and then went into music videos. And then from music videos, I started directing television and, you know, just kind of one thing after another.
So did they just let you take over? Like
the nightclubs?
Yeah.
Well, I was, this was in college, right? Right after we graduated from college, I had a creative partner that I met in college, and we started this crazy comedy dance theater group. And we'd have all the comedians in San Francisco, like Nora Dunn and Dana Carvey and all that sort of generation of San Francisco comedians would open for us. And we were working in the nightclubs to work our way through college. So I was the manager, the bar manager for the Boarding House, which is a very famous comedy music club in San Francisco. And my partner, Susie, was the manageress of the male strip club called the Off-Broadway. And so on their dark nights, we talked our bosses into giving us the clubs on the off nights.
Cool.
So when Susie wasn't riding herd on the male strippers, you know, she was, we were doing our show on Sunday nights and in the boarding house, we did, I think we had like Wednesday, I can't remember, Wednesday nights or something, whatever the off night was, that's the night we had.
That's fabulous. What cool bosses to let you do that.
Yeah, it was wild. It was wild. It was really fun.
Those were the days.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty great. You know, you're 20 and nobody ever makes any money, but we're such a success. We got a great review in the San Francisco Chronicle. We've made it. You know, it was just a very heady kind of time.
Neat, though. Have you considered writing a book?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there's so many things to write books about. But that time was really interesting. And, you know, North Beach in San Francisco is, all the clubs are owned by the old mafiosa guys who, you know, we made friends with, and they would, you know, help us with all the business aspects of everything we're doing and take care of any, kind of stray aggressive male strippers that wouldn't leave us alone for whatever reason. You know, it was wild. It was fun.
For whatever reason. Can't think of one.
Yeah.
Trey.
don't give me that. So like for me, whenever I'm thinking between all the things that you've done, between choreographer, director, executive producer, all of these things mixed into one. And for me, I feel like your vantage point when looking at a project changes when you have to like do these different roles. Do you find yourself easily moving through these different roles, or do they kind of all like have their segmented place in your brain?
That's a really good question. I mean, to me, it's all kind of problem solving. I love solving problems and figuring out how to do something, whether it's, you know, a story problem or a crazy creative problem or even a logistical mechanical problem. Like when I created the Marvel Universe Live Arena show, it was the first big live thing for Marvel since Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, which, you know, was not a great success for them. So, you know, there was a lot of pressure on us to really create something that made sense for the audience. So who's seeing these incredible movies, and like, how do you compete with that in live venues? And so that kind of creative problem solving is just really what fuels me. It's like, okay, how can we do the Hulk? How can we make this, you know, this creature come to life for the live audience? And how can we create these transitions that take people through the universe in a way that feels kind of filmic, but still is very live and rooted in being in the room with their favorite characters? So, you know, I think, or it's, you know, how do I work with a pop star and bring out what's best in them and create movement for them that feels organic and really shows who they are and lets them blossom as a performer? I mean, to me, it's all, you know, it's just all creative problem solving, which I love. In fact, I have my team, all my assistants are trained. Like when things get really frustrating, we're all just like tearing our hair out. Everyone's trained to kind of put on a big smile and go, another exciting creative challenge. Because it just, you know, it flips that switch and you kind of go, oh, okay, this is our job. We're going to figure this out. We can figure it out.
That's such a great attitude to have then. Like, we're going to just buckle down and make it happen somehow.
Yeah, well, you kind of have to. You know, tickets are sold, or the client is depending on you, or you gotta deliver. That's always, at least I feel like I do have to always deliver.
Right. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Do you have a particular like big wow moment that you had a hand or were responsible for creating that you still look back and see that as like a big highlight for you?
Oh my gosh. I mean, there's so many that occur, like, throughout your creative life. I mean, I went from, dancing on the street as a kid to, doing these nightclub shows that in our world we were a huge success. I mean, it was a giddy success when we got, our picture in the pink section of the Chronicle and these articles. I still have a framed review. It says, "Hot stepping troupe, all delight." It's like what the first review that we got, and I think the reviewer was really drunk actually, because what happened was I got ill. I something happened and I blacked out just as I was about to come on stage.
Oh no.
And it was like the second number of this really elaborate long show, and I was in almost everything. And so the whole rest of the team, like somebody had to take me to the hospital, and the whole rest of the team just ad-libbed the whole rest of the show. But the waitresses loved us at the boarding house, and so they kept getting the reviewer drunker and drunker and drunker, and just sitting there and talking to him and going, "Oh my God, isn't that the funniest thing you've ever seen?" And we were convinced we were just going to get this horrible pan review, but it was hot stepping troupe, all delight. So those moments are incredible. And I think every situation you go into, I mean, the first time I was able to executive produce a TV series and work with, the incredible talent that I was working with on that, and create something that had never been done before, and deliver thing, it's something that won awards. I mean, that's all of those moments, they just feel, you just feel so grateful and humbled for each of those things.
Of
But I
course.
don't know that any one thing is, yeah, the bartender, the note, the chat pays to have the bartenders and waits at the fireside, definitely.
For sure. My goodness. Who are the guests that we have in the background there?
Sorry, these guys,
Okay.
Nope, okay.
they really think you're in the room here, but they can't see you, so they're getting a little fatigued. Sorry about
That's okay.
that. It's
They want to be on the show too. That's okay.
okay. in terms of like, because you said that really anything that you'd look at is just this is another creative way of problem solving. So for you, on average, when you get a request or you get hired for a particular project, from beginning to delivery with the client, about how long does that process take?
Every project is so different. There's so many different timelines. When the Ringling Brothers brought me in to reimagine the circus in 2005, it was a big reimagining. They've just of course reimagined it again and rolled it out without animals. But at that time, the younger generation of the family was coming in, and they wanted to just take it in a new direction for younger families and make it, cool and hip, but not stray too far from the iconography of the circus, because Ringling is this incredible American icon. It's older than baseball. And so, going into that was, from the time we started to the time we finished, that was probably a 2-year process. Marvel Universe Live was a 3-year process from when they asked me to come up with a concept to pitch to Marvel to get them in business with the company who actually owns all the circuses and Disney Live and stuff, Feld Entertainment, really wonderful family entertainment company. They really wanted to do a live Marvel show, but of course, Marvel was a bit wary, based on their experience so far. So they hired me to put together a concept and go in and pitch it to Marvel. And that started a 3-year process between me pitching the idea and getting Marvel on board and then creating the show and all the R&D that had to go into it to try to figure out how to bring these superheroes to life in a live arena environment. And then to the, you know, the first show. Other shows, I work a lot with this incredible Asian music company, Tuinya, which is all the Vietnamese pop stars. I've been working with them for a couple decades, and they're just incredible to work with. My client there, Marie To, is this wildly imaginative woman who will just go, all right, we're going to Bangkok in a month, and we're going to do the biggest show that anyone's ever seen. And I'll be like, okay.
In a month.
Dive in, yeah. And we just dive in, and we do it faster than anybody can even imagine. And, you know, sometimes things are a little chaotic, and, you know, but we still, we manage to make it through, and it ends up being an incredible show. So I almost like a shorter time frame, only because you don't have as much time to overly analyze and discuss things. You know, you really just have to work from your gut, you know, and just kind of spew it out there and then look at it and go, okay, got to change that. Or, okay, we'll frisk it up later, but the bare bones are there. You know, I like that process, but it's nice to have time to perfect something as well. So.
I see what you say. What you're saying about having that shorter timeline, because even at the work that I currently do, prior to what I'm currently doing now, we would get, I don't know, like a couple months to work on a project. And then the team that I moved to, we got, I don't know, 2 weeks. So really, we got about a tenth of what we would normally be getting. And I felt like the quality of my work suffered, but it showed me that you can get something on its feet faster. Yeah. And then through the reiteration and so on and so forth, that's where you can really start to get and refine it and watch it go, okay, it was rough really at first, but now it's like, ooh, I can see the diamond. Ooh, okay.
Well, especially if you have the experience, you know, if you, in you're confident in your abilities, you know what you're doing, you can just kind of go, okay, this is what we need to do. Because you don't have to spend a lot of time decision-making on things that maybe you don't know so much. I'm guessing, at least in your field. I don't know. Maybe you can speak to that better.
Yeah, I have a lot of ambient noise, just so you know. I think it was an Amazon delivery. I feel like that's when you're in a really short timeline and you have to deliver, and you know there's all the pressure is on, and that's kind of where a lot of the magic happens. But it's magic that's based on all of your experience and your know-how. I'm sure Trey, you experience the same thing. I mean, you could, you know, look at a few different solutions and analyze which one is better. But in the crush, sometimes you just have to pick one and you have to go with your gut. But it's an informed gut, hopefully, because of all of the years of experience and all the other problem solving you've done before and all of the crazy physics that you thought you would never use from college. And yet somehow there you go. You're using your physics. Like, really? Okay. So I think the more experienced you are, the easier it is to work fast, is my summary.
I agree.
Got a couple little ones have 2 cents to put in too, it sounds like. They know. two comments from the chat. One was, a short deadline is a great way to focus your efforts. And so when things need to get done, we call Shonda.
It's true. I will get the job done. That's what everybody says. You know, it's like, you know that there will be a show. There will be a show if I'm there.
Since you've mentioned going overseas and working on shows across the way, I do have to ask, do you speak any other languages?
I actually speak kind of bad Chinese. It used to be better because I was studying actively. I speak just little drips and drabs of Vietnamese, which is really shameful. By now, I should speak fluent Vietnamese. But again, those timelines are short. There's not a lot of time to learn a lot of language, but I would love to speak more. And then I speak kind of passable French, which I use if I'm in Italy or if I'm in France, or, you know, I can use my French.
Fascinating.
So cool.
Hopefully I speak a little English. I try to keep that current.
That's good. Yeah. Obviously it's been helpful here tonight. You were going to say something, Trey?
No, I was not. Nope.
Okay. Kaz in our chat said, I speak Chinese. I feel like I knew that and I forgot, or maybe, I don't know. It feels familiar. So maybe I knew that already. I do not speak Chinese, but kudos to everybody who does, because that sounds very complicated. And languages that have Arabic characters, I feel, are a little easier, at least for me.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, Chinese is interesting because you can't, you know, the characters are pictograms. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if you can sound it out. I mean, there's some elements that are clues to, you know, like, oh, that's a kitchen. Okay. So this must be something to do with home. But most of the time, I mean, it's really pure memorization. Whereas with a Romance language, or, you know, with anything with our alphabet, you can kind of feel it out and sound it out, but not with Chinese.
No, there's no sounding with that. No.
Yeah.
No.
It's not logical.
But it's a lovely language to learn. It's actually really simple to learn. It's just that the characters are what's hard, I find. But other than that, it's pretty great. The tones aren't so bad. In the chat, they're saying the tones will get you. They're not so bad if you have kind of a musical sense. It's really, they're not so bad. And the structure is very, very simple, because they revamped it in the 40s to kind of be structured like English in terms of the grammar and stuff. So it's very simple. Hmm.
I see a few people on TikTok, like I'll randomly get foreign like content. And there's one girl who is currently living in, I believe she's somewhere in like Shanghai. And she is speaking fluent Mandarin, and it is incredible. And she gets so many compliments, but it's so fluid and natural. So it's really infectious to just sit there and watch and listen to her and go, okay, that is a goal. That is a long-term goal for me to learn, but I will get there.
Yeah, well, mine really, really slips unless I'm actively studying. You know, it's just one of those things. I have to keep it up. My French stays, but it's just because I have spoken that language for a lot longer. But Chinese, it just slips away. So I need to get back in there. I need to get back in class.
What's comparatively from like theaters or places that are outside of the U.S., what's one thing that strikes you as being very, very different between that and U.S. theater?
Well, golly. I mean, every culture has so much of its own, you know, language that obviously is expressed in the theater. One of the things that I love about China is the scale of the shows that they do. I mean, you can go to these outdoor shows where it starts in a valley in front of you and you think, oh my God, this is the most people I've ever seen in my life. This is the most spectacular, huge thing. But then as the show goes, they start lighting up more and more valleys beyond that valley. And then pretty soon they're lighting up a giant mountain miles away, and it's all part of this huge outdoor show. You can't even imagine the scale of it.
Wow.
You know, you've seen it. I'm gobsmacked by that. You know, culturally, I feel like China is so reverent of their own culture, which is an amazing thing, as are the Vietnamese. I mean, working with the Vietnamese artists that I work with, it's just such a beautiful, beautiful experience, because I've learned so much about Vietnamese culture, and they're I love how much they love their own culture and how reverent they are of it. You know, I really, really, really respect that. I think, you know, when you see, when working with the circuits was very interesting because you'll have on the field, you know, 120 people speaking up to 30 languages.
Wow.
You know, and each of those acts, you know, they come as a family, they come as an act, and they're very, in a way, they're one big family because they all depend on each other as they travel. You know, these two all travel on the train together, and everyone ends up, you know, sleeping with everybody else, and there's all kinds of little dramas going on, and you can always tell who's like hooking up with who because they start speaking the other person's language, and you know, it's very interesting. But working with these different acts and different nationalities, you really see all of this wonderful cultural pride and cultural identity, and just, you know, they say that some of the only stereotypes that are actually true are cultural stereotypes. Like, you know, you can say the Italians are very passionate, but maybe they're not as organized as the Germans, you know, and the Germans are very, very organized and, you know, buttoned up. And, you know, those things do tend to be true. It's very, you know, when they've done studies. And it's just so interesting when you work with all these beautiful acts and they're, you're not just working with them and their skill set, but you're also working with their culture and how they approach their work and their performance is all so informed by their own culture. And it's just a wonderful thing to be in the middle of that and get to experience it all. I loved it. I loved working with the circus because you just fall so madly in love with the people. You know, they're just the most incredible people you'll ever meet in your life. Just so noble and brave and committed and, you know, in it as in one big family. It's just an incredible thing.
That sounds so phenomenal.
Yeah, I feel very lucky to have had that experience with the old school circus. You know, now the new one I'm sure is incredible in its own way, but I haven't gotten to experience that yet.
One question from our chat was, have you seen Farewell, My Concubine?
Yes, of course. Beautiful, beautiful film.
I have never seen that or heard of that.
Oh, it's lovely. You'll have to see it.
Hmm.
Yeah, culturally, it's kind of a touchstone, I think, I feel like, for Chinese cinema. And, you know, it's one of the few films that we got during that time period over here. And it was, people fell madly in love with it because the visuals are so stunning.
So for a show like you described, where they light up hillsides and mountains in the distance and things like that, and something on that scale that's so visually remarkable, but also like amazing and maybe a little crazy to pull off, is there a desire to bring something like that here, or is it like a budget thing or a vision thing? Like, why aren't we seeing that here?
More of that kind of outdoor, immersive, site-specific, giant scale theater.
Yeah.
It would be very hard to do that scale here, I think, just because of the financial aspects.
Sure.
You know, in China, it was interesting because one of the giant shows that we went to see and we met with the creative people, it turns out that all of the performers are the people that run their farms. They're just like the local workers, and they have this extra job. You know, they run their farm during the day, and then they come and they perform in the show at night. And they're not professional performers, a lot of them, you know, just because there's so many, that just the numbers are so huge, all the people. And I don't know that we can do that here in the U.S. necessarily. You know, we just don't have the numbers of people to begin with. And, you know, the economics are very different here.
Okay.
But I do love, I mean, all these huge outdoor experiences. I started working, actually, when I was still living up in San Francisco, I did a couple shows for the Italian government that were meant to publicize different regions of Italy for tourism. And so they sent me on this incredible trip to Italy to meet with all the different artists and the designers and the different people that I would be bringing over for the show. And I got to see all of these incredible outdoor shows that the Italians do. You know, so they'll do it in an amazing, beautiful plaza. They'll do, you know, Franco Zeffirelli will stage an opera, you know, in a huge outdoor piazza. And it's very common, actually, in Italy to do those kinds of shows. And I don't think we do enough of them here.
I would agree. Trey would probably agree.
Yeah. Something so magical about like an outdoor setting and lit in that way. And, you know, just having things happen that you're not expecting.
Yeah, staging something in an unexpected location is it's so awesome to catch people off guard. We did, what did we do? I was trying to think of it. We did a production of, like a touring production of something, and I cannot remember the name of it, but the one that's coming to mind is one that my grad school actually did. And it was, they took a, just like a fold up sort of set where it was panels that you could project something onto in the background. And then that's how they changed scenery, did a whole bunch of things, but they took it on a tour all across Nebraska, a little bit into Iowa, I think. But they found that this somewhat abandoned theater had not had much in the way of it being done in a very, very long time. And it was original to like 1930s. They had done enough so that the building code wouldn't, you know, so it wouldn't fall down, but they staged it in there and brought so much back to that theater, and then turned around the next time and staged it at a local library. It was just so interesting and unique to be able to go see it at two very, very diverse locations.
Yeah. And did you feel like the different venues added a different character to the show itself?
100%.
Yeah.
It's, you said earlier that there's something that's different about live theater, and it's the fact that you never know what is going to happen. Every show is different.
Yes. Yes.
Much like this.
How so, Emily?
We never know what we're going to get. We never know what's going to happen from week
to
week.
You never know. Some of my favorite memories, actually, are when things went like totally awry, and just the machinations that you go through in the moment to keep the show going and just kind of deal with it. Those are the things that just make me laugh hysterically every time. And I know that the performers are always a little worried, you know, that I'm going to be upset with them or, you know, be fatuous about the fact that something went wrong, but I'm literally always just laughing about it because it's live. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Everybody just deals with it as best they can and keeps going. And we have one lead dancer who works with me on the Asian music projects, and she's worked with me for many years. She's a very famous dancer in the industry, Tracy Shibata, who is now touring with Pink and has been for like the last 10 years and is their dance captain and everything else. Very, very smart girl. And we were doing a piece that was very elaborate. It was a very story-driven piece of music, and the music had very little followable form. When I asked the composer and the producer, I was like, so we're having a little trouble counting this music. He was like, oh no, it's freestyle. And we're like, no wonder, you know, because we're having trouble counting the bars and structuring it so everybody can follow along, right? So poor Tracy is out in the front of a field of maybe 30 girls behind her, and they're all basically just following her because she is doing the movement at the tempo and just, you know, continuing to move, and literally not a single one of them can count it. So they're all watching her. And unfortunately, one of the actors, this little boy, had left a paper airplane on stage. It was supposed to leave stage because we're transitioning from his childhood to a war scene. And this paper airplane got left in the middle of the stage. And so I'm off to the side going, Tracy, get the paper airplane. Get the paper airplane. And she's just like giving me this side eye, like, if I do anything other than the movement, the entire stage is going to follow me. And I'm like, get the airplane. So she goes and she just gracefully dances over. She gets the airplane, and behind her, all 30 dancers in perfect unison followed her movement. Something up and left the stage. It was just so, like, you know those moments.
That's just wonderful.
They're just gold.
Okay. That's great. I love that story. Trey's mind is blown.
Not even gonna lie about that. That is incredible.
And Kaz in our chat said, you've met Tracy. Sorry, Trey.
Oh, yes. Tracy's pretty famous. She's amazing. She is just, she's extraordinary.
Well, clearly she pulled off the paper airplane thing too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And with grace and style, and it looked like it was all part of the choreography because everyone was in perfect unison behind her. There we go.
My God. So, okay. So comparing that to like directing something for television, how does that compare? How do you get away with that level of electricity, but capturing that on some transmission device?
Yeah, that's a really interesting conundrum. I loved directing when I was directing TV, for some reason I got funneled into comedy. And I guess it was because my, you know, I had a lot of comedy background and the people that I was working with, and, you know, they were doing some comedy, but it was almost just luck of the draw. I ended up working for Keenan Ivory Wayans on his talk show. And I was directing all the little sketch bits that, you know, roll in, and he'd do funny stuff with the guests. And, you know, there's always these little roll-ins on those talk shows, right? And so I got really, really good at doing comedy, but very specifically Black comedy, because Keenan, that was his realm. He was incredible. You know, he's just such a gifted comedian, and really understood, you know, his audience, which is this, you know, huge, huge audience. And so I got really good at doing that kind of stuff, and I love doing it. I mean, and I worked on The Man Show and a bunch of other like Comedy Central shows, and, you know, Fox, a lot of Fox comedy shows. And I think what's great about working with the camera is that you can focus people's attention and you can tell the story visually so specifically. Whereas with live, there's, you know, you're still doing that, but you have other tools. You have lighting, you have staging, you have things, but there's a lot more freedom for the audience in live, because they can choose to look over here, even if you're directing them to look here. And I think with the camera, you're always, you know, being very clear about how you want, what the point of view is, you know, whose point of view is this camera angle from, what is, you're telling the audience how to perceive that particular storyline by the angles you choose. And the, you know, it's just a whole different set of tools. I think I love doing them both. I really love working with camera. I recently was lucky enough to work on the new HBO show, Robert Downey Jr.'s new show called The Sympathizer. It's not out yet, but it's based on a Pulitzer Prize winning novel. And it's just incredible story that I'm hoping to see the finished show very soon. Yeah. And it was really nice to be back in that world and working with camera. you know, and setting up the, you set up the scene like you would in, for the scenes I was doing, at least, I was setting up as if it was a live performance, but then working with the DP and the directors on how to capture that. And, you know, it's just a whole different set of tools, honestly.
Wendy in our chat, who is, she commented that she loves watching your hands and movement, as well as your words. And I thought, yeah, you can tell you're a dancer because you have that.
Because I wave my hands around a lot.
Right. But I mean, like, it's the way you do it. It's not just that you do it. And I thought about that when she said it, because I do photography, and I am always really excited when I find out that the person I'm photographing has any dance background, because typically dancers are very aware of every little molecule in their body, at least from my experience. I'm saying this from the outside because I am not a dancer yet. Well, you never know. So from your standpoint, though, I mean, because you've been photographed before, I'm sure. Is that true? Like, you actually are aware of every little tiny finger, everything?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it just is sort of instinctive, like programmed into your body at a certain point, you know, like you don't even realize you're posing, quote unquote, because you're just, that's what your body does. Kind of. I know I wave my hands around a lot. It's like how I try to cover up the fact that I'm maybe don't know what I'm talking about. I just wait.
It works yeah. Very well.
Yeah. When I was a 13-year-old girl walking, dancing on the street, my older sister, she was a little critical of my arm movement. And you can see there's a lot of actual evidence that she was right. Like, there's pictures of me dancing and I'm like this, you know, and you know, I was awkward. I was 13. What do you want? But she was always on me about my arms and my hands. And so I think that that's how I developed a lot of stylish movement. You know, now they're like poetry. It's like, yeah, you criticize my arms, I will make them perfect.
That's wonderful. I wonder if the same kind of practice would make me photogenic. I was always just like ready.
Yeah, I never know what face to make anymore. I used to kind of know what face to make, but now, like, when somebody wants to photograph me, I'm like, oh, this one, I don't know anymore. I'm just, yeah, I give up.
When you brought up awkwardness, I was watching quite a bit, and I don't know if you've seen this show, but I've watched quite a bit of World of Dance, that competition show. And I love that show. And I'm always amazed at the dancers who take, like what you just said, something that looks awkward where you've got this, like, but they like turn it into something that's beautiful, because like there's awkward moments at all the right places somehow. And that has always fascinated me, because initially maybe I wouldn't see it as beauty, but then it becomes that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of hip hop around when I was an awkward 13-year-old, or I would have killed it. I would have killed that. No, I feel like dance has evolved in so many directions. But one of the most wonderful directions, of course, is personal expression, and how these kids now come up with this real understanding that they can move in a way that is so personal to them and so expressive of who they are individually. And it isn't the, you know, codified ballet style or the this or the that, you know, which have also evolved to incredible levels, but that form of personal expression that came from street dancing, and that, you know, it's given us so much freedom as creative agents. And for kids, it's incredible. You see, I mean, so many boys got interested in dance once hip hop became popular. It was just all of a sudden, all the little boys wanted to dance, because it was like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah, that is a great side effect of that. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I just thought it was so neat that something that may have been criticized once upon a time can now be used in dance for something beautiful or something meaningful or something to make, you know, the point or tell the story. And I just find that fascinating.
Yeah. Well, you know, the story about Bob Fosse, you know, one of the most imitated, revered, you know, iconic figures in American dance, was he had this awkward body. He had a turned in stance. He had a, you know, weird kind of hunched, you know, all these little quirky personal mannerisms. And that's what he based his style on. And look how, you know, popular that still is. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many Fosse numbers I've watched in my life. I don't really need to. it's hard to beat the original.
Of course.
Gwen Verdon and Bob Fosse dancing together is just incredible. You get a chance to watch some of that old footage. It's just amazing. One of my lucky things after coming to LA was I managed to fall in, even though I came as a director, I managed to fall in with a group of choreographers who, you know, had all kind of grown up together here in the LA business world, you know, show business world. And I wasn't here during that time, but I became an executive producer of the American Choreography Awards. And my particular job was editing all of the film clips,
Of
the tributes, like the Lifetime Achievement Award tributes. That
I love those.
All of those things. And that process was such an incredible education because I got to watch all of that old, you know, the footage that these people had generated through their lives and really look at their, you know, what they had contributed to our art form and to our culture, and also work with some of the older generation of choreographers who I revered, you know, Michael Kidd, who I had, you know, adored since I was a very small child watching, you know, those movies. And I became very close friends. And then when he was given an honorary Oscar, and he asked me to edit and create his clip package and his whole tribute for the Oscars because of the work I'd done with him on the American Choreography Awards. And I got to do that. And, you know, it's just amazing to get that kind of education about the history of dance and the history of this incredible generation that came prior to us. It's hard because now, I mean, at least there's YouTube and you can find anything really easily. And that's, you know, that's helpful, but I think it would be great if there was more emphasis on that for the younger generation of dancers to see more of the historical stuff and see where things came from, you know?
That sounds like quite a process to go through many film clips to find the ones that are, that sounds very time consuming, but also like choosing the right ones to create this sounds like quite an undertaking, but also very, what an honor.
Yeah, it's super fun. I mean, it's just hard to narrow it down, but it's super fun. It's like eating candy, you know, editing dance footage is like literally like eating your Halloween candy. Your Valoween candy.
Valoween candy, yes.
Yes.
We did get a question in the chat here. So for someone who wants to get into film work, like directing or story writing, what would you recommend them doing? Or how would they start that path?
Golly, I guess it depends on where you live. I mean, here, you know, in LA, it's kind of the, you know, the hotbed of the show business industry. So there's ways of, you know, meeting people and interning and getting into different situations where you can learn on the job. But I feel like the tried and true method really is going to school for it, you know. And now, I mean, there's so many wonderful film programs and, you know, directing programs and writing programs. And some of them are very, very expensive and very hard to get into. But there's also a whole new range of film schools who really will take, you know, almost anyone. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, it's just like a lot easier to access them, you know, like the what have we got? The Hollywood Film Academy over here, which is very close to me. A lot of kids come from all over the world to study there. And, you know, someplace like USC, I mean, that's the gold standard, but it's very challenging to get in, as we know from the recent scandals. People somehow shoehorning their kids in. But, you know, those programs are very challenging to get in. They're incredibly expensive. But there are so many programs now. Community colleges all have writing programs. I mean, really studying the craft is the way to go. And now it's so great because we don't have to wait for permission anymore. We have YouTube. We have the internet. And if you want it, there's no excuse. You know, you don't have to wait for someone to give you permission to make your short film. You can use your iPhone and it'll look phenomenal. You know, you could win an Oscar with an iPhone movie. I mean, people have. So there's not as many barriers, I don't feel like. It's a lot easier access because you can put stuff right up online and just start doing it. It's like anything else, you know, you have to get into it and do it and try it. And, you know, it's all just a trial and error, like anything else. I mean, with these comedy shows, the way that I got, you know, where I really felt confident with my skills with comedy, is we would shoot like crazy and shoot a lot of options. You edit it together. We'd play it for the audience before, like on the night before it was supposed to air. And we would see where it got laughs and where it didn't. And we'd cut the things that didn't get laughs and keep the things that did get laughs and really refine it in that way. I think, you know, it's like anything else. You just have to, love the process of it, of anything, to get better at it. You know, you have to just kind of love doing it.
Yep.
Part of that process, I think, is also getting feedback. Sometimes when you don't really expect it or really want the feedback. So how do you deal with feedback, particularly when it's not extremely kind?
Huh. Do you mean from clients, or do you mean just in general from people that you haven't, that you don't have any reason to expect feedback from, or?
I'm going to ask for both. Deal with harsh feedback from clients and then also harsh feedback from general audiences.
Well, I feel like with, you know, most of what I do is honestly work for hire. You know, I mean, there are things that I create just for myself, but most of my work is for a client. And so for me, that really fulfilling the needs of that client, who the audience is, all of those things. I mean, my whole process is I ask a million questions. I do tons of research. I try to really immerse myself in something before I start coming up with ideas. Because you can come up with a million ideas, but if they aren't affordable in the situation, if they won't work logistically, if they're not gonna, you know, really create what you're trying to create and give the audience a feeling that you're trying to give them, you know, they're not worth it. And then when you get into putting the work out there, at the point where the clients come and look at it, there's always feedback. I mean, that's the nature of what I do. I mean, I used to say, you know, I came up in network television, my life was one long note. You know, you're getting notes from your immediate boss, they're getting notes from their boss is getting notes from their boss, you know, and the notes in general are great. But often, you know, it's great to have that outside eye. I mean, that's always my point of view, is like, I'm so deep in it trying to make this work. Well, here comes an outside eye and going, you know, if you just did this, it would work. And you're like, oh, thank you. Because I couldn't see it. I was so deep in the weeds there. But the other thing is, sometimes you do get notes that don't make sense. But you have to kind of interpret what's the core, what's the real core, what's the kernel of that note. I can't do what they asked me to do because that'll just like upset the whole row of dominoes. That's not going to work. But if what we're looking for is this, like more, you know, we want to make this funnier and they're suggesting do it like this and you know that's not going to work, but here's another way to make it funnier. So you have to kind of look for the kernel of the note and figure out a solution that does work. Mm-hmm. You know, like you never want to be in a position of saying no to your clients, like, no, that's not going to happen, or no, we're not going to do that, or, you know, that's impossible. It's always like, okay, well, how can we make this work and make this happen? How can we solve whatever this mm-hmm. issue is? So I have not really been in the position much of like putting my stuff out into the world and having people just randomly critique it. Mm-hmm. No, I haven't been in that position much. I did write a feature script that, you know, it was my first feature script. So it, you know, the story's good, but my writing, you know, believe me, it's my first feature script. So it's not, there's a million things I could do better. And I did get notes from a man who I respect deeply. And they were just really random and kind of mean. And then he made a bunch of misogynistic jokes at the end. Mm. And I was really perplexed by it. Because this is a guy who is an executive producer and his business is giving notes to people. And so I was really perplexed by it, actually. I was like, huh. I mean, I was a little like, you know, mad, but like these notes, I wasn't mad about the notes. It was more that they were very random and didn't make a lot of sense. And then he made these kind of misogynistic jokes at the end. Like, that's what the notes are fine. It's like, it's all great information. And the thing to remember too, I think when you're doing your own work, you're not working for a client and you're doing your own work, people are going to have opinions on it. And it's really up to you to sift through those opinions and figure out what makes sense for your own intention. Like, you know, some of it, and I'm able to do that. I was able to do that with some of his notes. It was like, yeah, no, I really understand what he's saying, but he doesn't get it. This is really what I'm going for. And I'm going to stick with this, you know, and I've worked with enough really successful people who have stood up for their own vision that you kind of, you end up modeling yourself after that. You see that it's like, yeah, you know, yeah, I get it. This doesn't make sense to you, but it's something that's pretty subjective and it makes sense to me. And this is what I'm going for, mm-hmm. you know? So I don't know. There's a lot to notes. There's a lot to feedback. And I think you just have to have a thick skin and trust your own judgment and be welcoming, because if what you're doing is putting something out in the world for other people to enjoy, then, you know, you want to be cognizant of how it affects other people.
I mean, I really respect that answer. So I'm going to not take credit for this. So I'm going to give it to Wendy and Josh in our chat here, and it and echo what they're saying. It sounds like Shonda does a lot of careful listening, and I have to agree.
I do. I listen a lot. I make lots of notes and I ask lots of questions, but I'm also kind of a research junkie. You know, I find that like since the Felds, when I was working on the circus for them, they wanted to do something for the last year of the dragon. So that would be 12 years ago, right? And so they came to me and they said, we want to do a dragon circus. That was it. That was the assignment. Here, go. So I went off and I just started researching dragons. And I discovered that every culture around the world has their own dragon mythology. Mm-hmm. And each of those cultures has a different type of dragon. Like the Nordic, we're very familiar with the dragons of like the, you know, the European fairy tales, the fire breathing, you know, fierce dragons. But then in the Southern Americas, they have the wise Ouroboros who eats his own tail, you know, all that mystique. The Chinese, the Asian dragons are all very wise and very kind and, you know, these incredible, these deities, basically. What was the fourth dragon? The Northern European, that was the South Americas, there was the Asian. What was my fourth dragon? Oh, the African dragons from the, you know, that continent with a whole other flavor there. So my creative for that show was really born out of that research. So I came up with the idea of there's a pageant of dragons where all of the tribes from the four corners of the world have come together to compete in this pageant of dragons. And they each had a tribal identity and sort of an iconographic dragon. Jake's weighing in. He said, that dragon was great, mommy, but there's time for dinner.
Thank you, Jake.
So I listen, but I also am just really fed by that kind of research. And, you know, you find that it makes all your ideas kind of burble and come to life.
I have one last question for you, unless Trey's got one last question for you. And that is, if you are going out dancing tonight, this weekend, whatever, what kind of dancing are you going out for?
Oh, wow. I like to do all kinds of dancing. I mean, I'm not that great at certain kinds of dancing, but I really love to, it's really fun to social dance, obviously. I love old like blues and soul and that kind of, you know, that just makes, I was brought up by that with that kind of music because half my family's Black. And so I was raised basically in that culture, and that makes me, you know, want to move and go crazy. I love, you know, a lot of current pop music, you know, from Beyonce to, you know, country stuff. I think line dancing is super fun. It's kind of mindless and super fun. And those guys, when they lead you, it's so much fun, you know, to follow the cowboy lead. I love that. So basically whatever. I probably wouldn't go to a electronic rave necessarily or heavy metal, like, you know, headbanger concert, but anything else I'm up for.
Cool.
I respect that. For our audience at home, I just have two last questions.
Yeah.
First one, if someone were to want to get into choreography, like more the directing angle of things, what advice do you have for someone just starting out?
Into choreography specifically?
Or directing.
Oy. I mean, it's really just doing it. I mean, if you want to choreograph, I'm assuming you're a dancer of some sort. And, you know, you enjoy designing movements. So just do it. Get your friends together, design some movement on them, see what it looks like, film it with your iPhone, post it on YouTube. You know, same thing with being a director. I mean, other than going into a great program and studying and really, you know, learning from great instructors, I think it's about doing it. It's about self-education. It's about getting out there and trying it and just, you know, seeing what works and what you like and what, you know, what really gets your ideas out in the best way.
I love that answer. So it's do it, just go do it and see what works.
Yeah, pretty much. As I said, I think we're so lucky these days because there are so many outlets for personal expression that we never used to have. You know, you had to go knock on the door of, you know, some gatekeeper to let you direct something. Well, you don't need to do that anymore. No.
There's so many great projects that I've seen. I watched a documentary on somebody who Hollywood approached him about taking a lot of his scripts and really wanted to change all of them. So he said, no, I'm going to go do it myself. And wound up getting so many more accolades. Now, please don't ask me his name because I'm terrible with names at this point. But it was just so refreshing to watch someone make the film that they wanted to, design it the way that they wanted to, and watch their vision come to full fruition.
Mm-hmm.
My last question for you is, make sure that our listening audience can stay in touch with you with whatever projects that you've got going on. Where can our listening audience get in touch with you?
I have Instagram. I think they put that up, didn't they? It's Shonda Sawyer One.
Yep.
Instagram. Mm-hmm. I've got, you can write to me at my website, I guess, or Facebook. I'm on Facebook too. Yeah, there it is.
I put it in the chat.
I have to be honest, I don't go on Facebook a whole lot, though. So if you write to me on Facebook and I don't respond, please don't take it personally. Because I really rarely go on. But
well, everybody, go follow Shonda on Instagram.
Which yeah, because I have literally like 10 followers at this point. So come on.
You can be one of the first million followers by going to follow Shonda right now on Instagram at Shonda Sawyer One. Also, the dragon circus is that able to be seen by anybody out there?
No, unfortunately. I think there might be a little bit of it online. I've got a few clips of it on my website. At ShondaSawyer.com. There's a few little clips of it. That was one of my favorite shows I ever did. It was just, it just everything about it just turned out so great. I was able to go to China and hand select Shaolin monks to come and be like the key, like core performers. Like they were a through line through the whole show. Oh my goodness. I mean, that whole experience of going to China, selecting them, and then working with them, because I mean, talk about a work ethic. They just were phenomenal to work with. It was one of my favorite shows ever.
I mean, if you just want to trade places for a day, like, I wouldn't mind.
We had a giant fire-breathing dragon that came around at the end. The storyline was, you know, there was this pageant of dragon tribes coming to compete in the dragon games, but set against that landscape, there was a real dragon and only one person could see them, and just they would see a tail or they'd see an eye or they'd see a head. Nobody believed him until finally at the end, the dragon comes out and we see that he was right all along. There was a real dragon.
Yes.
That's cool.
It was so fun. It was the best. I wish I had that dragon here in my house. I would have it breathe some fire for you right now.
That'd be great.
That'd be amazing.
Well, Jake may not agree, but we would.
Jake would probably just, as long as he gets fed, he's cool with it.
Is Jake this white dog with the blue eyes on your Instagram?
No, that's the mommy Snowy that we just rescued from the kill shelter.
Oh, right. Okay.
Babies. They were slated for euthanasia because if the pups are still nursing when the mommy runs out of time, they evidently euthanize them all. So I couldn't handle that when I came across it at late at night in a vulnerable state. So I took them in, and now they're happy and gorgeous. And yeah.
Good. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, they're so amazing.
Well, that just makes me want a dog more right now. Well, Shonda, what I can say is this has been incredible. I love your perspective on that a problem is not a problem. It requires a creative solution.
It's an exciting creative challenge.
It's an exciting creative challenge. And I love the way...
Yes, you got to do the smile. It's all about that smile. You could be crying, but you know, as long as you face on that smile.
All right, I'm going to go to my boss tomorrow and I'm going to be sobbing. But I'll be like, it's another creative problem solving.
An exciting creative challenge, Trey.
I will make sure.
I love it.
But in all sincerity, I love how positive that you are and how much that you bring to even the questions that we brought you. At no point have I ever felt like you look at something as just meh. It's always like, how can I do that? And that's what I love.
Yeah, well, it's gotten me into a fair share of trouble as well.
Oh,
But it's just my nature, you know. I'm really like, oh, okay, I can probably do that. Let's see. Let's see. Let's try. Yeah. Well, you guys are wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on. I
thank
really appreciate
you.
it.
Thank
Absolutely.
you. I had a great time too. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, everybody, and I hope you have a great day. Happy Valentine's.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.